right, my friends, we will begin our second half. I was just reflecting on how wonderful it is to have an evening of the seven factors of awakening. I mean, it's just such like a great bedtime story to be able to end the day with this in our hearts. It's really wholesome. And I'm again very happy to be here, and I'm sitting in for Lauren, and she wishes she could be here. All right, so now I'm going to be talking about the calming or stabilizing factors, tranquility or calm, concentration and equanimity. So as Sue said, these factors balance out the energizing factors. They help promote a quiet, calm, steady mind after it's been kind of agitated, or not agitated, but energized. And there's a sense that we don't need to move away from whatever is happening when these factors are have arisen. And all through these factors, as Sue's mentioned, runs the thread of mindfulness. And so often these qualities of calm or tranquility, concentration and equanimity just seem so far apart from us, like not part of our personality at all. I remember first hearing about equanimity, and I just, you know, like head for the door. I wasn't ready for it. I was so much involved in my, you know, the three poisons, and I wasn't ready to let go. I didn't really understand what it was. And so I'll be talking about that a little bit too, the misunderstandings about what equanimity is. As was mentioned last month, it's easy for us to notice when we're in the grip of painful emotions, you know, craving or aversion, restlessness, sluggishness, doubt. And we even have a tendency to really solidify our mind states with them. We say, oh, I'm a restless person, or I'm, you know, I'm just greedy, I'm lazy, you know, I'm a doubtful or skeptical person. But in fact, these seven factors of awakening are also very much a part of us if we would only recognize them. So they're found within us, and we have the potential to cultivate them by seeing them, and then also cultivating them intentionally to some extent as well. So we just have to recognize and value and cultivate them on the cushion in our daily lives. So to some extent, especially when we're on retreat, we do some of this more intensive practice, and we follow the seven factors in a sequential manner, kind of following a natural progression during our meditation practice. And, you know, they develop naturally through this continuity of mindfulness. We don't have to make them happen. We just have to recognize them and be mindful of them when they do arise. So we left off with rapture and joy, and this mind state is full of energy and maybe even overwhelming energy. And if we continue the process with mindfulness, though, this rapture and joy kind of settles down and turns gradually into a quieter kind of happiness, which is, you could call, tranquility or peacefulness. The body is at ease. So this is the factor of tranquility or calm. And when we're still, calm arises, and this affects the body and mind. So sometimes when this factor is strong, you could just sit in it forever. If you've ever had bliss, if you've sat with bliss, you know, oh boy, you do not want to go anywhere. And when that bell rings and you've got to go and eat, you don't want to do that, because you're like greedy like me. You don't want to do anything. But really, in that state, you don't have to go anywhere or do anything, because it is full in and of itself. And the Satipatthana Sutta says we are to know when these factors are present and when they're not present. And we are to know what strengthens them toward the potential of awakening. So I like the image of a child blowing out the candles for the first time on a birthday cake. you know, moving from that excitement of joy and that bloomed sense of warmth and well-being and ease. And that moves from that total excitement to contentment. There's no agitation or confusion there. And the Buddha actually has an example of someone been lost in the desert, having seen an oasis and filled with joy and bliss, having just drunk some of that water, feeling happy, and then lying down on the side of the banks by the pond, content. That's how he described that. The mind is quiet and still, the body is at ease. And in that state, the mind is not easily distracted. And as I said before, whatever the experience now is enough. But if you're like me, you don't really want to let your busyness go. I'm very attached, or you know, that the egoic mind of problem solving, urgency to act, better to do than be, really is pulls hard. So when do we experience that happy comfort of body and mind? It's available. It's as Rodney says, it's, you know, it's available as close as turning and looking to whatever is right next to you. So the next factor, concentration, or I like to call rock steady, born from that calmness and that stillness, and the Pali word is samadhi. This stable mind is directly proportional to the ability to relax and be still. It's a sense of the mind being gathered or unified around something, yet still spacious. Now, there are concentration practices that really do that one-pointed focus and concentration, zooming in on one thing like the breath. But this is a steadiness of concentration that can sense the movement of the arising and passing away of objects, can move from one focus and to another. Have you ever watched a child draw? There is that keen interest and focus, yet there is also the sense of knowing who's in the room and the sound that's also heard. So when concentrated, composed, or gathered, the mind, again, is not interested in anything else. And it's not making up stories or content. It's just present in the moment. You can lose track of time. And when you find yourself in this state, for me anyway, the words faith and motivation, it's like you have those nuggets that you've seen your capabilities in the practice. You've known it for yourself that this is available to me. We've experienced it for ourselves. And it's also important to remember that a reason for developing concentration isn't just for, like we say, the spiritual goodies, the beautiful mind states, but it's for that precision of wisdom to also arise and see things clearly for what they are, for that stability, which is going to be very important when the next factor arises. So equanimity. So, you know, it's interesting when I mentioned before that the word equanimity I shied from because I wasn't willing to put down my views, my opinions, my overindulgence in sensual pleasures, whether it be drink, food. I didn't want to renounce. And that's also part of this because the Eightfold Path is alive in these seven factors. Nothing is by itself. So right view, right intention is alive always through these factors too. So equanimity is the balanced view, is the ability to hold all things with all experiences without reactivity. And to get a clear idea, some definitions to consider are the following. Equanimity is the ability to see without being caught by what you see. Equanimity is the ability to see with patience. Equanimity is the ability to see with understanding. Equanimity is the ability to remain centered in whatever is happening. Also, I think it's helpful, important to know the near and far enemies of equanimity to have a better sense of what it is not. So the far enemy of equanimity is reactivity, that state of the mind where we grasp what is pleasant, push away what's not pleasant, and refuse to acknowledge what's happening because we're just upset and we know the way things are because we're thinking it in our heads. We all know that state of mind. And the near enemy is indifference, where we don't really care or we're not engaged in what's happening. Both of those are totally off, especially the equanimity around indifference, thinking that it means, you know, not to care or that there's non-action involved. It isn't that we don't care. There is depth of compassion and equanimity. We care very much, but the stability of mind has that ability to see clearly, and we're not overwhelmed by emotions. I have a funny experience working at a school where I have duty in the morning. I have to walk along a fence and welcome people up the trail. The fence is right abuts a homeless camp that is gigantic and on a lake in North Seattle. And so I stand there and I love welcoming people up, but my mind goes directly to all the problems I see. The garbage, there's garbage that shouldn't be there. You know, we've got to do something about this or that. My mind is always trying to fix. So equanimity is more about what's the indicated thing to do right now in this moment. It's embracing the three characteristics that, you know, everything in life and all things that we experience in life, not personal, perfect, or permanent. And I like to use the word too, equanimity is like alignment with the present moment. And I think I like to use the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That's equanimity to me, acceptance. So we fall down and we catch ourselves by recognizing when we're not abiding. You know, that's just as important as noticing, wow, I'm equanimous. So I worry about my aging, the care about my aging mom, and this actually causes me to lose sleep. But the good thing about this is I've learned through the practice that I can zoom out and I realize, oh my gosh, I'm leaning into this fixing, thinking that I can actually solve this. And so I remember nothing is perfect. And it actually gives me peace to abide in knowing that, as I put it, life, living a life is a beautiful moving act of imperfection. Things are wrong, you know, all the time. And as I practice, I watch my mind to see how much I focus on what it's noticing, that what is wrong and what I should do. And, you know, none of this is our fault. We're wired this way. And then in addition, society, culture, families condition us. Everything is conditioned. So the state of equanimity is such an important place in practice because it's considered to be a place where our mind is ready to open to what isn't known because we're putting everything aside, our reactions. So we're ready to see the truths that we haven't been open to before. And so it's like a doorway to what's not conditioned. So to remember about equanimity, that it arises from the continuity of mindfulness, from concentration and tranquility. But more important and more lasting, it arises from wisdom. From sensing for ourselves the impermanence of all experiences we might wish for, their ability to not really satisfy us in the long run, from seeing clearly for ourselves that resisting or denying what is already happening right now only brings suffering. And so that's a bit of a renouncing there too. We can hold the pain of the world without taking it on through reactivity. Oh boy, I get into it though. You know, with my family, we're talking about this and that. And I'm like, yeah, but I really try to practice wise speech and non-harm. And it's that is just important to come back to your intention. So, but in with equanimity, the mind stops reaching when it knows there's nothing to reach for with that ultimate satisfaction. When we experience our life and the world through that big picture lens of equanimity, I like to call it balanced view, or even zooming out, you know, like a bird in the sky sees the big picture. And in the Satipatthana, it points to this in the very last refrain. It says, dwelling independently without clinging to anything in the world. So when this factor is fully developed in the Arahant, free from sensual desire and discontent, covetousness and sadness has left us. I've got to say, I used to have despair. I would have at night, I would just have this physical flushing my body with despair. I don't have it anymore. We embody the Dharma. We get out of our way. In recovery literature, I love this. We cease fighting anyone or anything. We stop running the show. We leave the mind alone. I love to get stuck in the reactivity, the stickiness of thoughts and projects and wants and aversions and personalities. But, you know, we wake up. It's fun. I like to wake up to it. And like, oh my gosh, I'm doing that. It's not very equanimous. So we say okay to situations and experience in our lives. And I also like how a person said that, you know, life doesn't set terms. We always say on life's terms. Well, actually, life doesn't set terms. So also just in closing, we cultivate equanimity every time we do our Vipassana practice, just being with what's unfolding in the present moment. And we learn that everything arises from conditions, causes and conditions that are out of our control, much of them, and that things are as they are right now. And we can hope and be open to what's present rather than resisting and denying what's already happened and brings us suffering. So I want to close with two things. One, that these beautiful qualities grow from our intention. That's all. A willingness to see with sincerity and practice, persistence in our practice. And when we cultivate these factors, we're growing in new soil. The soil is not bothered by the weather. It's not the flower that grows above. It's the soil that's holding the deep roots, deep, steady, quiet, non-reactive. And the external factors, conditions of our life change, but the soil just is. It's equanimous in the sense that it gives all equally and benefits all beings. So I wanted to share a poem Lindell wanted to offer, and that is called The Moment by Marie Howe. Oh, the coming out of nowhere moment when nothing happens. No, what have I to do today list? Maybe half a moment, the rush of traffic stops. The whir of, I should be, slows to silence. The white cotton curtains hanging still. Thank you for your practice. Now we're going to pause. Suze is going to offer a topic for our breakout rooms. And then I will work on breaking you out.
No, that's not what's going to happen next.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. You and I were going to just focus. Before we go into breakout rooms, we were each going to just share a couple things about how to practice with the seven factors. And so then I'll do what you said.
Sorry, yes. I gotcha.
Yeah, we're good.
Why don't I start since?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm right here and it's fresh in the mind. I think the biggest thing is that we can't make them happen, but we can try to be aware that they're present. Okay. That's really huge for me because I had liked to effort. So doing things that are favorable. Remember I talked about the child who, you know, draws for concentration, you know, take the time to do something that puts you in a state that enables you to have that stable mind. Some of you have mentioned in the past gardening or art or, I just like to stare at nature. So that's important. Also, you know, noticing when you're attached to a pleasant state. You notice when you're attached. And then you can say, wow, I wonder how I can be a little more equanimous with that. So I'm attached. Can I approach something that you're averse to, whether it be a food or a type of person, perhaps? And what would it take for you to have an open mind and heart where perhaps you're not reactive? You let go of your opinion for the day, watching whatever news channel or even people. I mean, I live in a rural area and I have developed some judgments about people with big trucks who I guess are somewhat scary. And then I start talking to people and it really is humbling. So if you ever find yourself in a pleasant state, appreciate it. Oh my gosh, I am calm and tranquil. I mean, it's not funny. It's important to cultivate. And in concentration, I mentioned before, doing something that enables a steady mind, but also perhaps metaphrases, chanting. For equanimity, I like the song, All Things Are Impermanent. They arise and they pass away. To be in harmony with this truth brings great happiness. That gives, just really offers equanimity to me. And there is, am I out of time?
No, keep going. You're good.
I have one more beautiful passage that I wanted to say, if I can find it. It's this notion is that nobody asked to be here. We're all here uninvited. Do you know? And so someone died. And the mother said, uninvited, he passed away. As he came, so he went. What is the use of lamenting, weeping, and wailing? So this is pointing to kind of the you might want to say, the magic or amazing fact that we are here in the first place, that nobody, we don't own this life and others in our life. They're given to us freely and they leave. So that gives me I practice with that sometimes. So that's all I'll offer right now. I think Suze can offer some wonderful practice.